A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until 1, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce from the award-winning This Is Money to talk through some of the stories on their website they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, this week we asked, is it an end to austerity? Osborne pulls another rabbit or two out of his spending review hat. But as the dust settles, economists poring over the fine details, is it all just a bit of hocus pocus?
Because I've been able to announce today an improvement in the public finances, the simplest thing to do is not to phase these changes in, but to avoid them altogether.
This is absolutely not the end of austerity. We are still seeing spending across a range of departments falling. We're seeing spending as a fraction of national income falling really fast.
Also today, we investigate the greedy banks looking to use government's Help to Buy ISA as a cash cow by paying pittance in interest to young savers. Talking of pittance, we also look at the banks that have been sneakily slashing cash ISA rates. The advice? Move your money now or face becoming another victim. But hey, it could be worse.
It's an extraordinary move. You're paying the high street bank for the privilege of having a savings account.
We'll investigate that as well. And regulars to the show will have heard us mentioning phishing and vishing in the past, but the new kid on the scamming block is smishing. We explain what you need to do to avoid the fraudsters. And love it or loathe it, Black Friday predicted to be the biggest shopping day ever in the UK. Remember those scenes from last year? Yes. What exactly is this shopping madness all about? Is it really worth getting in on the action on days like this with Cyber Monday and Manic Monday on the horizon? We'll be giving you everything you need to arm yourself and how to keep your details safe online. But we are asking today, as it is Black Friday, I want to know, are you in or are you out? If you are in, what have you bought? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Lee. I'm going to start with you, Simon. Welcome back. I want to know for you, please, are you in? Are you out?
I'm out.
Why?
I just like, if I'm going to be entirely honest, I don't really like shopping that much. Yep. My shopping tends to be a very sort of male endeavour, which is know what you want, go to shop, leave shop ASAP. Mm-hmm. And I've got to that point in my life where I don't really need anything else. I've got a lot of stuff. I need less stuff. I might pay someone to come round my house and remove some things. I definitely don't need more things. So I'm out. Also, I'm a lot more of a it's the 23rd of December man than buying before December starts.
Well, you never know. There might be some deals on removal men on Black Friday. So worth taking a look at that one. Lee, I'm going to come to you and ask you, are you with Simon or are you not?
I am with Simon, but I will go to one shop today and that will be Gap because Gap has 50% off everything and it's the only day of the year that I will go to Gap. Yeah. And it's a good place to stock up on boring essentials like pants and socks. So good quality stuff. Everything's half price. I'm in there.
So you are actually in?
Well, just for one shop.
Just for one shop. On the whole,
I'm a 23rd of December kind of guy. I hate buying Christmas presents. Last minute job done.
I'm with you, Simon. I am out today. I don't like shopping. I don't like going online to shop. There's just too much choice. I get a little bit overwhelmed. And to be honest, I got burnt last year, didn't I, Annie Weston?
In a big way, yeah. We just bought useless purchases.
That's true. So every purchase now, I have to go through Annie to veto it or not. But Annie, paying lots of attention to consuming issues this morning, you are most definitely in, aren't you?
I am so in. Mm. I actually purchased something whilst on air earlier.
Yes, you did.
I bought a duvet cover set that I've had my eye on for months
now. That's how exciting you find me, Annie.
Yeah, well, my life is exciting with these kind of purchases. 400 thread count, don't knock it.
Okay, yeah. Savings, though?
Savings, about 50 quid today. And this was something I was going to buy a little while ago. So I feel like this is a good choice, well made.
Well, that's fair enough. If it was something you were going to buy and you actually wanted anyway,
yes,
then that's fair enough.
It's
I
not
think
impulse.
My problem is I can't think of anything I want. So then I look at all these deals online and I'm just like, meh.
Exactly what he says. Annie, what have we got?
Okay, so Paul has gone and got himself a new bike saddle. Excitement. Rich has bought a set of mixing bowls from John Lewis and a board game. Kate says, I've just logged on to the ASOS clothing website. Wish me luck, 20% off everything.
I'm with Lee on this one. If it's not, that's a 50% or nothing.
That is great, Lee. Yeah. 50%.
Yeah. Might join you. You're going to brave going to the shops.
The one in Kensington, you know, no one in Kensington is really hunting out bargains, so it's fine. It's just like a normal day in there.
Does people in Kensington actually go into Gap?
Well,
bit quiet, isn't it? Annie,
please do get in touch. Black Friday, are you in or out? If you're in, let us know what you're buying. I'm intrigued. You can tweet us at Share Radio UK. You can text 66777. Just start your text with the word share and standard network rate supply. Or drop us a line at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk.
Thank you very much, Annie.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Foss. You're listening to Share Radio. We're here on digital in London, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm here every weekday from 9 until 1. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, running through some of the stories they've been looking at on our behalf over the last 7 days. And today I'm joined by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And this was the week we asked, is this the end to austerity? George Osborne scrapped his plans to cut tax credits, but told MPs he'll still save £12 billion from the welfare budget and £20 billion from public spending. Our reporter Barry Weir rounds up the Chancellor's autumn statement and spending review.
It was a change the Chancellor didn't even try to hide.
Because I've been able to announce today an improvement in the public finances, the simplest thing to do is not to phase these changes in, but to avoid them altogether.
Yeah. After weeks of opposition, criticism and a painful defeat in the House of Lords, George Osborne decided not to go ahead with his planned tax credit cuts. That was at the start of the speech. Towards the end, after speculation of cuts to the policing budgets, the Chancellor had another surprise.
Now is the time to back our police and give them the tools to do the job. I am today announcing that there will be no cuts in the police budget at all.
Some of the other announcements, a new central fund worth £250 million for tackling the problems of potholes, described by motoring groups as a drop in the ocean. New house building plans for England, a rise in the basic state pension, and the £15 million yearly VAT from the so-called tampon tax will now help fund women's health and support charities. But how is he going to pay for all this? Well, big companies will be hit by tax rises through a new apprenticeship levy.
Every employer will receive a £15,000 allowance to offset against the levy, which means over 98% of all employers and all businesses with pay bills of less than £3 million will pay no levy at all. Yeah.
Government department budgets are being slashed as well.
The core Cabinet Office budget will be cut by 26%, matching a 24% cut in the budget of the Treasury.
Unions say that means services will be torn to shreds. A new stamp duty on buy-to-lets and second homes is coming in, and experts also think George Osborne will take in more than previously thought when it comes to tax and national insurance. Labour's Shadow Chancellor welcomed one of the decisions.
Today, the Chancellor has been forced into a U-turn on his tax credits. And I want to congratulate the members in this House on all sides who made this happen.
But he says the government's broken its promise to get debt falling.
Well, that was our reporter Barry Weir rounding up the Chancellor's autumn statement and the spending review as well. So, Simon, before we drill down to the nitty-gritty, particularly buy-to-let changes I know you've been writing about recently, what did you make generally of the spending review, the autumn statement? I'm speaking fiscally, politically. The mood now the dust is settling appears to be slightly more on the critical side, perhaps. You've run the rule over it. What did you make?
Well, I think that it was very lucky for George Osborne that he managed to find £27 billion down the back of the sofa. And the suggestion is that basically there's been an improvement in the public finances. And actually where he's really won out is the fact that the cost of servicing all that debt that we've got is lower than it was thought that it was going to be, which is due to, you know, the outlook for interest rates dragging down gilt yields. I think that the one thing that he does deserve a lot of praise for is scrapping the decision on tax credits, mm-hmm. that U-turn. I think that basically it was pointed out to him that this was going to hit 3 million people for, you know, £1,000 a year, and that this was the wrong way to go about it, that tax credits did need reforming, but this was not the right way to do it. And it's better to change your mind and not do something than it and admit that you were wrong than it is to just plough ahead regardless. And you, he could have just ploughed on regardless, saying, no, this is the right thing to do. So a lot of credit to him for that. I think if you look at the figures, though, the projections go out to 2020. Now, nobody really knows what's going to happen in the future. Certainly not looking 3-4 years out. We're in a time of great uncertainty. Things could get better. The economy could pick up. Those figures could actually be better than it's thought. We could take in more money in tax than we expect, and that'll ease the pain of the austerity. Or things could get worse. We could suffer another recession. And if that happens, then we do have a big problem.
Now, Lee, you were looking into the predictions before the speech. Big winners turned out to be the NHS, defence, foreign aid, spies. Of course, that high drama with the U-turn on tax credits, not cutting the police budget. And we'll drill more into those in a few short moments. But the winners and the losers, was it by and large what we thought it would be, apart from the odd rabbit in the hat that we mentioned a little bit earlier?
Yeah, it was. I don't think there was that many surprises. I mean, the big one probably was stamp duty for second homes and buy-to-let properties. I mean, that sort of just came out of nowhere. I don't think anyone sort of saw that coming. But on the whole, I mean, a lot of it was kind of what we was expecting. And again, the big thing is the tax credits U-turn. And as Simon rightly says, I mean, one part of me gives him credit for saying, like, look, I've listened to people and this is going to be, you know, a bad move for millions of people. At the same time, you know, he only announced it 4 months ago. Feels a little bit political. He knows how to play that political game. And let's not forget, he's done so many budgets and all the statements now. He knows how to kind of play it.
Tax credits, of course, benefit payments for those on low incomes aimed at topping up their pay. They are the biggest welfare cost to the government, apart from the state pension. But with changes to the criteria of universal credit coming in, actually some people will still lose out, won't they, anyway?
Yeah, some people will lose out. But, I mean, it remains to be said that the way that the tax credits were going to come in, and they were going to come in and they were going to hit very hard straight away, pretty much £100 a month from the poorest 3 million working families, according to the IFS figures. I think the universal credit changes are going to be much, much gentler than that. But it does remain to be said that you can't cut down on your benefits bill and on all this state spending without some people suffering somewhere. And unfortunately, if you are going to cut down on your benefits bill, the people who are most likely to suffer from that are the people who get the benefits rather than the people who aren't getting the benefits. And it should be borne in mind when people say that the Chancellor is only hitting, you know, the poorer people in society, that actually the rich have lost a lot of tax perks. You know, if you earn more than £150,000, you won't be able to put more than, you know, £10,000 into your pension. That's coming up soon. If you earn between over £100,000, you have a marginal tax rate of 67%. All those family households that earn more than £50,000, have an earner on more than £50,000, going up to £60,000, have had child benefit taken away from them. So actually, when you take all of those things into account, it has taken quite a lot of money off the people higher up the scale. But the fact of the matter is that they're in a much better position to afford it.
I do want to ask you, you mentioned there about some people suggesting the Institute for Fiscal Studies saying that the Chancellor got lucky with that extra £27 billion. How on earth can you suddenly find £27 billion, as you say, down the back of the sofa, as it were? Why did we not know about this before?
Well, I don't know. It's a very good question. I mean, you would think that with all the scrutiny that goes on of the public accounts that someone would have potentially raised that in the time running up to it. And I mean, I think primarily, you know, the big win, as I said, was these lower debt payments. I mean, the thing I would say, though, about looking into the future rather than into the past is that I'm looking here at the sort of the table of receipts on which it says how much the government thinks it's going to get in income tax and national insurance and VAT and corporation tax and then all those other things. And there is forecast to be a sizable increase in the amount of money coming in between now and 2020. And we're talking about a third more money coming in between now and 2020. And I'm just not so sure that that's actually going to happen.
I want to ask you, before we get on the buy-to-let stamp duty changes, other announcements that were made that will affect the pound in our pocket. I'm thinking here in terms of pensions, wages, childcare, students, indeed. That was a surprise.
Yeah, so just to quickly sort of talk about some of those things. The pensions, we've got the basic rate state pensions going up by £3.50 something, I think. I'm not sure of the exact figure. And the flat rate state pension that's coming in is going to be just under £156, £155.65, I think, when it starts in April. Of course, the big problem with that is that a lot of people who think they're going to get that aren't going to get that full amount due to having contracted out. I think one of the controversial things actually in here was also the apprenticeship levy, which is going to be this 0.5% tax on firms' payroll. It's bigger companies, you know, with more than 3 million, but it's still going to hit quite a lot of companies. And that is forecast to be pulling in, I'm looking at the figures here, £3 billion pretty much from 2017. So that's quite a lot of money. And companies have said this is, you know, this is a stealth tax.
Well, I was going to say, Simon, it just sounds to me that this is a statement of tax rather than cuts. I mean, of course, cuts were made as well, but not of taxes. Some a little bit sneaky.
Yeah, maybe. But then the problem is that what the Chancellor did in the run-up to the election was pretty much promise not to raise any of the main taxes that are more headline taxes. So there was a promise not to raise income tax, national insurance or VAT. And once you've done that, and also committed to balancing the books over what is a relatively short period of time from a point where the books are not very balanced at all, you put yourself in a bit of a corner, to be honest. So, yes, you're going to get stealth taxes.
Also, I want to ask you, some economists say that the Chancellor's plans bear an uncanny resemblance to those of former Shadow Chancellor Ed Balls. It says that Mr Osborne abandoned £30 billion of planned cuts to departmental spending, effectively bridging the gap between Conservative and Labour pre-election policies. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I heard this morning, actually. I thought it was quite funny. Basically, the line was, this is pretty much the budget that you would have got if you'd voted in the last Labour lot. I mean, I'm not so sure. So basically, you always find that when you vote in a government, they don't do exactly what they said they were going to do anyway. They always do something slightly different. So I'm not sure whether this is exactly what you would have got. It's very different to the one that you'd get if you voted in the current Labour leader, though.
Lee, your views?
I was going to say, you mentioned students there, and one of the big losers, actually graduates, who already now pay £9,000 a year from 2012 to study. Yeah. Now, when in 2010 the plans were announced, it was said that the threshold in which you start paying back your graduate loan was going to be £21,000, but from 2017 it would rise with, you know, annual wage inflation. And Osborne has actually sort of gone back on that now, and it was buried in the back of the autumn statement, about page 93 or something. And it's going to cost graduates £300 million or so by 2020. So the amount that you're going to be paying back your student loan is going to be frozen at £21,000, while, you know, you hopefully wages will be going up at the same time. But it means, you know, graduates are going to get really stung, as well as having coming out with tens of thousands of pounds of debt. And that's something that seems to have gone largely unnoticed.
On the plus side, that does actually mean that they will pay their loans off quicker. Should be said that they will actually pay their loans off quicker and with less interest. But unfortunately, we've created this student loan system where the justification for it is, don't worry, lots of you won't ever pay off all the debt.
Actually,
if you're using that sort of logic, it doesn't quite work.
Well, is there hope on the horizon for young people in terms of housing, I wonder? Plenty to get through. Plenty of announcements were made with regards to property. Firstly, before all of the statements were made, we found out George Osborne's plans to hand billions to private developers in order to build 400,000 new homes in England. That was followed by the bombshell of a 3% stamp duty surcharge on buy-to-let properties from the 1st of April next year. Paula Higgins, the CEO of Homeowners Alliance, says she hasn't got that much sympathy for the landlords when first-time buyers are struggling to get on the housing ladder.
We hear every day first-time buyers are really desperately trying to compete with the same properties, but they're not cash buyers. It's difficult for them. So I do think the dust will settle and it will be overall good news to have a more stable functioning housing market. We will see more people moving out of the buy-to-let market and freeing up these houses for first-time buyers. And you have to remember, the buy-to-let investors, they're not actually building new homes. They're just, you know, renting homes out. So, of course, we need reform of the rental market, but overall, we're not that sympathetic with the landlords.
So the death knell for buy-to-let, Lee? Explain what the change is. Give us some of the figures as well.
Yeah, so absolute bombshell from George Osborne, this one. This sort of came out of nowhere, to be quite frank with you. So landlords, people that are buying buy-to-let properties and those buying a second home, are now going to face far higher stamp duty bills from April next year than they would do presently, which could mean a real flurry now between now and April when these changes come in, because you get the savings of thousands. So you're going to get charged at least 3% stamp duty.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't sound like a lot, but that's just on the first £125,000 of property. On the next £125,000, instead of paying 2% stamp duty, you're going to now be paying 5% stamp duty on top of that 3%.
Wow.
And for anything over that, well, not anything over that, but in the next block, instead of paying 5% stamp duty, you're going to be paying 8%. So that is a massive tax hike for landlords who already got hit in the last budget, because I think the Bank of England have been looking very, very closely at the buy-to-let market, and they're trying to do something, I think, to sort of, you know, extinguish it a little bit, because there's such a shortage of homes for people to buy at the moment. You know, mortgage rates have come down to absolute record lows, but it's no good having these record low mortgages if there's no houses to buy. Now, this stamp duty change has been, you know, as you'd suspect, very unpopular. And you can see why. For example, on a £275,000 house, instead of a £3,750 bill, you're facing a £12,000 bill. I mean, that is a substantial hike. And on a £500,000 home, instead of £15,000 stamp duty, you're looking at £30,000. I mean, that is a sizable rise in stamp duty. Now, last December, he did make changes to stamp duty that made it cheaper anyway. But this still means from April, you're going to be paying far more than you would have done under the old slab-style system.
Lee, is it for everyone? Because I understand commercial property investors, people with more than 15, are expected to be exempt from...
Yeah, I've heard
new
this.
Charges. Is that right?
And I must admit, we haven't gone very focused on that. So I'm not sure the whole devil in the detail about big portfolios. But, I mean, if that's the case, I mean, it'd be very strange to have a rule for one and not for the other. But, you know, we'll have to nail down on that and perhaps talk about that next week.
So is everyone going to plough in now, between now and April?
Well,
is that thought?
You know, if landlords want to save thousands of pounds and they're interested in getting to buy to let, I mean, I would suspect there is going to be a rush. But... What is there to buy? You know, it's a lack of supply, and they're battling people, you know, just normal residential buyers who are, as I say, getting some of the most attractive deals currently available, you know, for a long time.
Also, one letting expert describing the move as catastrophic for the private rented sector.
Yeah, so this whole argument that, you know, to offset these extra costs, it just means rents are going to go up. You know, you can kind of see the logic behind that. You know, rents haven't been going up at a completely ridiculous price. I mean, I think sometimes we look at these things with a London hat. You know, of course, you know, there's a lot of demand for rental properties in London because properties become so expensive, people can't afford to buy. But I think overall rents haven't been going up, you know, at the same pace as house prices. But, you know, the fear is that tenants, especially in London, will probably end up paying a little bit more for rent for these new houses that get snapped up by landlords with bigger stamp duty costs.
Now, Simon, you've been looking into this in a little bit more detail, the buy-to-let stamp duty tax trick that landlords still have up their sleeves. So reveal all, if you would.
Well, there is actually a way that landlords can claim at least some of this money back, which is basically when you come to sell your buy-to-let or your second home even, you don't have to be a landlord, you have to pay capital gains tax, which as an individual private homeowner, you know, an owner-occupier, you don't have to pay, you have an exemption on, you don't pay any capital gains tax. Now, for a lot of people who've made a lot of money out of buy-to-let over the last 20 years, especially if they bought 20 years ago when houses were cheap, those capital gains have been very, very big indeed. In fact, it's not unusual to see people having made maybe £100,000 on a property, especially if they bought one in the London or the South East. But they face a capital gains tax bill on that, which above their annual capital gains tax allowance of just over £10,000 is either 18% or 28% on the remainder of the money. And for most people, it's going to be 28%, because not only are they likely to be higher rate taxpayers anyway, but you add the amount you get in capital gains onto your income in a bizarre tax trick to decide your capital gains tax rate. But the one thing that you can do is offset costs against that, and those include buying and selling costs. And one of the buying and selling costs that you can offset against your capital gains tax bill is stamp duty. So landlords and second homeowners paying this new enlarged stamp duty charge can actually claim it back at the other end. Now, of course, it's worth pointing out that what that'll do is basically, say you'd made £90,000 worth of profit and you'd paid £10,000 worth of stamp duty, that brings your profit down to £80,000 and you then pay tax on the £80,000. So you're not saving the full 10, effectively, you're saving the tax. But it is still a neat tax trick that gets some of the money back. Interestingly as well, the information about this used to be on the old HM Treasury website, but everything's moved over to gov.uk now and been simplified. And the bit about stamp duty is missing from the new simplified gov.uk website. I mean, read into that what you will.
Also, though, you've also been writing about it. So buy-to-let is the golden child no more you talk about there. But the idea, I suppose, that the property market getting very hot, this is going to hopefully help first-time buyers who are competing with the buy-to-let. But actually, you say, has George Osborne come to his senses on the property market, decided to slow it down? I'm not so sure, after all. Buy-to-let landlords were happily snapping up properties under the old slab-style system that existed before this time last year. So in that regard, you expect it not to slow down, and actually they will quite happily just pay that extra tax.
So I think this could go two ways. Right, so firstly, you could either work on the basis that if you look at buy-to-let, people have been snapping up properties when stamp duty was much higher than it is now on residential property. Now, as Lee just pointed out, for landlords, it's now going to be higher than it used to be. But it's not going to be that much higher. You're talking a couple of £1,000. There's been some property experts saying, well, if you factor into account house price inflation and your property goes up by 5% in the first year, then you'll make back the extra stamp duty easily. Of course, that relies on the fact that you presume house prices are always going to go up. So it could just take a bit of momentum out of the market, I think. And I think maybe the Chancellor, I don't think he's had some kind of Damascene conversion and has decided that actually this booming property market is a bit of a problem. This, after all, is a man who rolled the dice on the property market 2.5, 3 years ago when he was really struggling to get a recovery going. He was really struggling to get growth. And even though house prices were too high in this country and there had been plenty talked about it, including by the Conservative Party, he just went, all right, let's go all in. Help to buy, free money effectively to buy houses off the back of funding for lending, put a bit of swagger back in the property market step, and off went the UK's property-dependent consumer economy again. So has he decided that actually this was a terrible mistake? I suspect not. If you look at those figures I was talking about earlier, you know, he expects the tax take from stamp duty to keep rising and to get more money from this charge on buy-to-let and second homes. So I don't think he's thinking it's going to stop people buying buy-to-lets. So it could just slow it down a bit. But, you know, it could go the other way. It could be that this is just because what you find with markets is it's quite often not some kind of like big bang that derails it. And it's something that people think actually they could keep on working their way past. But maybe this just might be the sort of straw that breaks the camel's back, the thing that tips it the other way. Because you've got the changes coming to mortgage interest, so you won't be able to claim back all of your mortgage interest against your tax bill. You've got extra regulation coming down the line. At some point, interest rates are going to start rising. Are we running out of people who can access the money to buy buy-to-lets? Properties are very expensive compared to wages. Could this be the thing that tips it the other way? I don't know. We'll see.
We shall see, indeed. They did say that £1 billion raise will be going towards the £7 billion to build 400,000 new homes, because it's all about supply and demand when it comes to this. Lee, do we welcome this move? I thought we needed to build about 250,000 a year to get anywhere what we needed. What's this 400,000 we're talking about?
That's the estimates that, you know, various reports often sort of say. I thought it was quite interesting on the Thursday morning after the Autumn Statement, I was just watching BBC News, and there was George Osborne in Essex with his hard hat on, you know, at a building site. Now, 400,000 homes in the next few years sounds fantastic, but hey, where are they going? So Holloway Prison, for example, is going to be now turned into a block of flats because it's an old, decrepit prison, you know, and people are going to build some new prisons, and, you know, that's where demand for housing is strong. But I just can't see how, you know, you get the NIMBYs. They're not going to want hundreds of new homes in their, you know, little market town where people are actually looking to buy. Let's face it, the majority of people are looking for homes in London and the South East that commute into London. You know, are we going to have to start eating into green belt land? You know, it's all of those sort of arguments. It's all well and good saying, oh, it's going to build 400,000 homes. You know, will it happen? I don't know. As Simon says,
we're worried about the skill shortage as well.
A skill shortage, brick shortage. We've got a shortage of everything when it comes to building a home. As Simon said, this is volatile times. And I don't know how you can promise to say we're going to build 400,000 homes by 2020. There could be a recession next year. You know, who knows? And then house building can completely just, you know, grind to a halt again. So, you know, Conservatives really do like this whole, you know, people buying their own homes, you know, type mantra. Yeah. But you tell me, I want to see a map, George Osborne, of where all these 400,000 homes are going, please.
All right, then. I'll put the request in. Simon, your views?
Well, we talked about the NIMBY thing before, actually, and I think actually one of the big things when you listen to this whole NIMBY thing is they don't trust the government or the local authorities or the developers to, A, deliver housing of a decent standard that's going to fit in nicely with the local area, sympathetically. But also, more importantly, they don't trust anyone to put the infrastructure in place to do it. Mm. And so everyone wants to live in the south, southeast of Britain. And yes, there's actually plenty of green fields that you could stick houses on. But all the kids, there's already not enough school places for children. They've already shut a load of the hospitals, so you have to travel miles to get to A&E. The roads are already full and the trains are already full. And without all of those things, the people who already live there are saying, we can't have more houses. But one of the things about the builders thing that you alluded to there, Georgie, is, I mean, Osborne said, we are the builders. And we had a story yesterday where we asked the question, are we the builders? Because actually, industry bodies have warned that there just are not the skilled tradesmen available to build all of these houses. And we have a big gap between the number of builders and carpenters and plumbers and things that we have and the number that we need. And actually, if you suddenly did go out and build all of those houses, you would push the price of building a house up so much that you'd probably add a load of extra house price inflation into the bargain.
Well, whether or not we get those new homes, there were still plenty of other
I mean, it'd be good to get them. I'm not saying it wouldn't be good to get them, but I'm just saying it's not that simple. It's not Bob the Builder just comes in and knocks up a few for
you. It's not Sim City. You can't just like click a button and there's a big pile of houses being built.
We'll ask that question in a few years' time, but there was plenty else in the speech as well related to property. We were talking about investment in shared ownership schemes, reduced rent for those saving for a deposit, specialist homes for the elderly, also a chance that council tax bills could go up by quite some amount as well. Also, a London Help to Buy scheme for those within the capital who can save a deposit of 5% on the value of a property they want to buy. They'll be able to get an interest-free loan for up to 5 years worth, up to 40% of the value of that home. But sticking with the Help to Buy ISA, you've actually got an article on your website. Are they actually going to be any help at all? Why? Because of greedy banks, the government flagship tax-free savings accounts, which gives those saving for a house deposit 25% bonus, was meant to be the leg up for the first-time buyer. But this is money I've learned. Banks may only pay less than 1% interest on that Help to Buy ISA. So, Lee, just recap for us, if you would, a bit more about the Help to Buy ISA scheme and what's going on here.
So they're introduced actually from next week, and it's meant to be a leg up, as you say, for first-time buyers who are to fund a deposit to actually buy a property, which is the biggest stumbling block for most when it comes to buying a home. So people will be able to save £200 a month, and you say government will provide a 25% bonus on that, so that's an extra £50. You could save into it for a maximum of 5 years. So if you put 12 grand in, you get 15 grand because the government will give you up to £3,000 maximum to put towards it. So the first sort of deal was come out today from NatWest, and it's a 2% ISA rate. So it's a tax-free account, so that's the first bonus of it. But as you rightly say, we just don't know what kind of rates are going to be coming out. NatWest 2% sounds pretty good when you compare it to other ISAs at the moment. I know that Britain's biggest building society has got its coming out tomorrow, its rate. Can't reveal it now because it's under embargo, but I can say it's slightly better. And there are a few other banks that are coming out with them. But, you know, the worry is, are sort of the big guns, you know, let's talk Lloyds, let's talk Barclays, let's talk HSBC, what kind of rates are they going to be bringing out on these? Because cash ISAs, they have absolutely plummeted in the last couple of years. They've become a really sort of unloved product from banks and building societies, where once upon a time, you know, stretch our mind back 3-4 years, we had something, cash ISA season. It feels like a distant memory now. They used to climb over each other to offer the best rates and entice savers in. But these tax-free accounts have become
I remember your excitement, Lee. I do. Mm-hmm. It was a whole event in itself.
Black Friday's overtaken it.
Exactly. But in terms of that, I mean, banks slashed 389 ISA rates this year, up almost a third on last year, saving banks $1.5 billion of interest payouts. We may as well have a word on that one now.
Yeah, there's just no interest. There's no appetite to get these tax-free savers in at the moment because, you know, these banks and building societies have been largely tapping into the Funded for Lending scheme, which was a large pot of money that the government put out to borrow to let banks tap into to lend out in the form of mortgages. That's why we've got rock bottom mortgages and savings rates that can keep falling. Now, cash ISA rates, there's just no competition because the smaller challenger banks that are coming into the fray at the moment are all focusing on fixed rates because they're quite simple products to offer and they know exactly how much money's coming in, how much interest they're going to have to pay over a couple of years. ISAs are quite complicated for a new challenger bank to actually set up. And I think a lot of them are just thinking, what's the point? So, you know, this week we've seen National Savings and Investments, actually last week, they've reduced the rate on its Best Buy ISA that's tumbled down the table. I've just got a letter from HSBC actually saying that my cash ISA is falling from January. NatWest, they've launching this Help to Buy ISA, but at the same time, they've cut their rates on a normal cash ISA. So,
well, the advice on your website is move now or miss out. But where would you move to?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, there's some cash ISA rates that are still going to be probably better than the ones that have been slashed. So I think Virgin have one at 1.56%, which is an easy access. West Brom Building Society have a 1.55% rate. And then if you're willing to get some fixed ISAs, you're looking at a little bit more interest. But they're nowhere near as good as the fixed rate savings that I've talked about.
I do want to bring you back to the Help to Buy ISA one. You said they're NatWest at 2%, but Money Mail has discovered they could be as low as 0.7%. Simon, which is it?
Well, I think the issue here is, so Sylvia, our savings expert and Money Mail's savings expert, has done some digging here into, you know, what's going to happen. And the problem is that none of the banks and building societies have been willing to make any kind of commitment to say, yeah, we're going to offer these Help to Buy ISAs and we're going to make sure that the rates are as good as they are on a standard ISA. Because people are going to be attracted to these Help to Buy ISAs by the bonus you get from the government, the £50 bonus for saving £200, which if you take that, massively outstrips any gain that you would get from interest. So the idea is that basically the banks and building societies are going to get away with paying people lower rates on those accounts because they're going to be attracted by the bonus anyway. And I would treat this article of Sylvia's really as a bit of a warning shot across the bowels of the banks and building societies. And I think that the banks and building societies, they read these stories. They are monitoring what's going on in the press. They're reading Money Mail. They're reading This Is Money. And they will have looked at that. Maybe it changed a few minds. I mean, I know that, you know, now the rates are coming a bit closer. Now we're starting to get them under embargo. And, you know, we've got sources telling us that actually the rates probably aren't going to be as bad as was suggested in that. But there is still not a commitment from the banks and building societies to say, we won't diddle you on this compared to a standard cash ISA. And there has been a long-standing thing whereby they used to do this on cash ISAs and standard savings accounts, where a standard savings account was slightly higher rate than the cash ISA because they knew people would be attracted to the ISA anyway and they could get away with paying them a lower rate.
Lee?
I was just going to add, with this NatWest 2% rate, it's worth pointing out that it's variable. So at any point, they could cut that rate. So I think it's worth pointing out, and it's worth keeping your eye on that. If you're looking for one of these Help to Buy ISAs in the next few weeks, see if they're variable or see if there's any sort of promises to keep the rate at the rate that's been given at the start to continue. Because if they start cutting them, you know, pretty early doors, you just can't predict what's going to happen with these.
Well, at least, Lee, the rates remain in positive territory, do they not? Taking a look at another story on your website, a small Swiss bank is believed to have become the first hit savers with negative interest rates. The alternative bank, Schweiz, told its customers and it warned them that they'd face a minus 0.125% rate on their money from 2016. That'll drop to minus 0.75% on deposits above 100,000 Swiss francs. It echoes the Swiss central bank's minus 0.75% negative deposit rate imposed on financial institutions placing money with it. Well, here's Share Radio's personal finance expert, Ed Bauscher.
obviously it's an extraordinary move. You're paying the High Street Bank for the privilege of having a savings account. And I think, you know, it's not going to happen in the... I think it's unlikely to happen in the UK, because remember, the Bank of England base rate is still in positive territory, 0.5%. In Switzerland, minus 0.75%. And most people expect the next move in the Bank of England base rate to be up, not down. So I'm not expecting this in the UK anytime soon.
Interesting story, Simon. Tell us more.
It is an interesting story, isn't it? And I wrote this on Sunday. I was working on Sunday and it came to my attention on Sunday. And actually, it was a pleasure to sit and write this on a Sunday afternoon, to be honest. Because I'm a geek, basically. I should just add that in. You know, no Premier League for me. I'm writing about negative interest rates. Woohoo!
Now, why were you so excited?
Why was
to write
I so excited?
Sunday?
Well, because this is very unusual. So, the Swiss Central Bank introduced this negative rate sometime back earlier this year, minus 0.75%. And this all ties into this very strange interconnected global economy, exchange rates, super low interest rates, and this idea of the zero lower bound for rates, the point below which putting them down doesn't make any difference at all. What's happened is the Swiss bank brought this in for banks holding money with it. Now, this bank, Alternative Bank Schweiz, or Alternative Bank Swiss, as we may refer to them, has written to its customers and said, basically, this is costing us money. In fact, actually, it effectively wiped out our entire profits for the year. Now, this isn't just any kind of bank. This is a kind of social and environmental bank that invests in social and environmental projects. So if you've got your money with it, you've already put your money there because you think it's going to do good. So they've written to their customers and said, unfortunately, we're actually going to have to charge you to hold your money now, because we're being charged for by the central bank for holding money there, and that's wiping out our profits and we can't do any good. So we're going to charge you this minus 0.125% standard, and if you've got more than 100,000 Swiss francs, it's going to be minus 0.75%. And actually, they said that the reaction from their customers has been reasonably positive. There haven't been that many who've said they were going to leave, and actually they think that the publicity from it may bring them in more customers, or at least balance it with the number who want to leave. Which just goes to show what a strange world that we live in, doesn't it? But what's behind this is the fact that basically central banks want people to be spending or investing money into something productive. And people don't want to do that. They want to put their money into the safest place they can possibly think of. And the safest place that many people could possibly think of to put their money was Switzerland. And so Switzerland was struggling to keep a cap on its exchange rate, because the more money that flows into Switzerland, the higher the Swiss franc goes, which is great for any Swiss people who want to go on holiday somewhere, especially seeing as presumably if you're Swiss, anywhere else in the world seems exceptionally cheap anyway, but is bad for Swiss businesses, of which they do have some, because it's almost impossible for them to sell to other people when the prices are rising all the time. So the Swiss central bank stopped trying to keep the rate down, and they basically introduced these negative rates, which meant that anybody parking their money in Switzerland was now going to have to pay to do it, which discourages people from parking their money there. But there is this thing in economics where basically, and this was something that the Bank of England economist Andy Haldane talked about sort of earlier this year, where he suggested maybe we might have to even think about interest rates below zero in another crisis, which I don't think is actually going to happen. But the problem is that once you get down to a point where interest rates are effectively zero, there's not really anywhere for monetary policy to go. You can keep cutting rates, but if you keep cutting rates below zero to negative rates, so that people are having to pay to put their money in the bank, well, if you're a financial institution, you just have to take that on the chin, because you need to park money with a central bank. But if it was you or me or Lee, or a business, you just go, well, I'm not paying the bank to keep my money. So you just hoard cash. So you just take the cash out, keep the cash in your house. It's like if the bank, you know, so there comes a point where lowering those interest rates doesn't work. And that's where ideas like unorthodox monetary policy come in, such as quantitative easing to inject money into the financial system, or even the so-called helicopter drop, where you just basically put money into people's accounts to get them to spend it. So the Bank of England would just go, right, here's £2,000 each.
Go on then.
Whack it into people's accounts, pump some more money into the economy, and people go out and spend it.
So in sum, this is probably a problem that's very unique to Switzerland, not likely to see something like this happen to banks over here.
In a sense, that is true. However, it's not entirely true if you look beyond about a year ago when inflation started falling. So when inflation was stuck at a nice above 2% level and your bank account was only paying you 0.5%, in real terms, after adjusting for inflation, you were losing money and you did actually have to have a negative savings rate. Fortunately, at the moment, inflation is actually below zero, it's minus 0.1%. And so if you do have a cash ISA paying you 1.5%, you might feel like you're losing out, but actually you are making money.
Inspector Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce from This Is Money.
So you want to learn to make the most of your money. Of course you do. But you want to learn while also listening to satirical songs and sketches. Of course you do. And that's why we invented Managing My Money. Let me move your rates up
and down. Let's talk about huge debt. So won't the real big savers
please stand up? Please stand up. Managing My Money is an official Open University course. You can take the tests and earn yourself an Open University certificate to show how financially savvy you've become. So join Annie Weston and me, Glenn Goodman, on Share Radio 6 days a week. And if you miss an episode, you can go to shareradio.co.uk to find out when it's repeated or just download a podcast instead. It's never been easier to fill that hole in your no-zone layer.
And do go online for more information. A very warm welcome if you have just joined us. Now, one thing you certainly need to think about, we're going to be talking about Black Friday shortly and Cyber Monday and Manic Monday and Christmas, is staying safe online. There are typically more attempted online shopping scams at this time of year than any other. But the team have been looking into another type of scam that seems to be pretty prevalent at the moment. Now, regulars to This Is Money podcast will know about phishing. That's where criminals send fake bank emails to trick us into revealing our account details. And of course, vishing, that's when fraudsters obtain personal details of a victim by phone. But what about smishing? You just made this up, haven't you guys? Barclays, PayPal and Apple are now warning that millions of customers are vulnerable. Lee, give us the details, please.
Smishing is SMS, so text messages, combined with phishing. So smishing, there's the explanation for that. So people are very aware, I think, these days about getting dodgy emails and don't click on those links if it looks like something suspicious. I think this has been a rise of forces that are targeting mobile phone users, and people probably don't quite realise that, you know, they can do this. Now, the biggest problem with this is, let's say, for example, you're a Barclays customer, and I've written about this before. If you use Barclays Ping It, for example, I established that quite a few people were getting these phony text messages. And what fraudsters are managing to do is attaching these fake messages onto genuine-looking threads. So if you, for example, have received a few genuine text messages from Barclays in the past, they're somehow managing to attach their phony text onto that chain. So it is quite easy to fall victim of this, and it will just have a link in it saying, you know, you've been a victim of attack, there's been suspicious activity, please click this link to make sure all's okay. And, you know, you click on that link, you might get, you know, some sort of virus on your computer which enables fraudsters to lurk in the background and steal, you know, bank details, especially if you use mobile banking. Or it could trick you into revealing details. So I had one case of someone who had this sort of phony Ping It system, which is a system that Barclays has where you can make payments to people via the phone. And he phoned up the number because it looked so genuine, and it started asking for certain account details. And he started typing them in, and then luckily he sort of thought, wait a minute, no, this is a little bit dodgy, alerted Barclays, and it turned out to be dodgy. So if you get a text message that looks like it's from your bank and it looks suspicious in any kind of way, please do not click on that link and just check with your bank that that's something genuine. Even if it turns out not to be something genuine, it's good to report these things.
You've also mentioned here what to do if you are a victim of a scam. First thing you should do, contact Action Fraud. You can report a fraud via the online fraud reporting tool or calling Action Fraud on 0300 123 2040. Or if a debit or credit cards, online banking or checks are involved, your first step should be to contact your bank or your credit card company. And how timely, as we are talking about shopping. Love it or loathe it, Black Friday, predicted to be the biggest shopping day ever in the UK. Experian reckons retailers will take more than £1 billion online. That's almost £12,000 a second. I've not even got started on Cyber Monday and Manic Monday. But if you're not sure about this American import, well, neither, it seems, are the shops. Odbins recently joined Asda as the latest retailer to boycott it. Its MD, Io Akintola, says, "We will not offer artificial discounts, attempt to get rid of wonky stock, cannibalise our own sales or pressure our customers to jump like lemmings with credit cards into the collective madness of Black Friday." Strong words there. I spoke to retail expert Vic Slayton.
You've got to be really big and really brave to pull away from it. What our data has shown at Quidco is people are doing the same amount of shopping, but it's just when they're doing the shopping. So if you're not in the market this weekend, then you might well miss out. And I think it takes a big name like Asda to be able to say that they're not doing that. But for the people who say they're not participating in it, they probably are. They might have put deals in that they started a week ago just because they're not in the absolute fist fight for all of Black Friday itself. They're probably doing some clever discounting as well to make sure they're not missing out.
It's definitely a risk, but we think it's a calculated risk. In retail, you know, if you ask customers what they want, you listen to them and you act on it, generally that's how you become a winner. And what we're expecting to see next year is many of our competitors will withdraw from Black Friday. It'll become a very, very different event. But certainly this year, not doing Black Friday and investing in products people want to buy in the run up to Christmas feels like a much more sensible thing to do. We know from our own research, customers this year, for example, at Christmas, they've got a little bit more disposable income, but they've told us 68% of people we've spoken to have said, we're not looking to spend any more money this Christmas. In fact, 21% of them have said they want to spend less. So it's all about how they're going to invest that money. So I think Black Friday is an event that drives some sales at Christmas. Whether that drives additional sales at Christmas is questionable.
Well, Vic Slayton, their retail expert. First off the back, Russell Craig, a director at Asda. So, Lee, Black Friday, good or bad for business?
Well, it depends the way you look at it. I mean, it's all very well and good boosting sales. So we've got some data here that shows, for example, department stores such as John Lewis, Debenhams, you know, sales are likely to quadruple today. But what does that mean for profits? I mean, are profits still going in line with that, or are they just trying to get more people through with these enticing Black Friday deals? I think it's very interesting this year that Asda pulled away from it. And the big reason why they pulled away from it is because last year it had so much negative press from people just sticking TVs in trolleys. There was fist fights. I think in Manchester, the police force actually criticised the supermarket for having no security there. It was just absolute chaos. So it obviously wanted to step away from that. But interestingly, Asda says it's not doing Black Friday. And then this morning, it announces that it's dropped the price of petrol to below £1 a litre for the weekend. Now, OK, it hasn't labelled that as Black Friday. And in an advert, it said, you know, this is just a little Christmas present for our, you know, customers. Well, interesting, it's done it on the weekend where Black Friday lies and, you know, all other competitors are doing these deals. So is it good for business? Well, it depends if you think photos of people battling for TVs is good coverage.
Well, if people go online, I suppose. But we were laughing a little bit earlier, weren't we, about the fact on your website, it's Black Friday deals end Monday. And they've been going on the week before as well, let's be honest. So is actually ultimately this going to be really bad this year for retailers who are forced to lower prices at a time when we want to buy stuff for Christmas?
Yeah, we talked about this last year, didn't we? And and we've talked about this over the course of the year, about this sort of sales culture that we have in the UK. And there's a report put out by business consultancy LCP that said one third of retailers believe Black Friday is unprofitable and unsustainable. So while people reckon nearly £1.9 billion of sales will be rung up over the next few days, they also think that the event is losing momentum. And also, what you're doing is you're pulling forward sales. So they're getting a load of sales today, as Lee pointed out, but they're getting a load of sales on stuff that's being sold at a deep discount. So are they pulling in enough people to buy those deep discounts and then getting enough full price sales today to make up for those deep discounts? Or have they, what they've done is introduced an extra sale element now, then people don't buy anything, or they buy much less between now and the week before Christmas, when all of the shops have now pulled forward their sales, what would have been a Boxing Day sale, to before Christmas. And so everybody just waits to the last minute, buys the rest of their presents before Christmas, and then buys the stuff in the sale. And so instead of selling stuff full price in the busiest time of the year when they should be selling things full price and getting people to effectively pay as much as they can for goods, they've got people used to this idea of only buying on a discount. And I think that the UK High Street has a real issue with some of the discounting. And you walk down the high street, we all know those shops and those chains where there always seems to be a sale. And if stuff isn't on sale, you just will not buy something there.
Well, that's what we were talking about. Regular listeners to the show will remember Lee mentioning the only time, Lee, you ever go into Gap is if there's a discount. There's a discount on today, you're going in.
Yeah,
what's that do for the business?
It's such a juicy discount today that I think there's no point of going in any other day. I'm not going to pay full price for something when I know full well that once a year it's going to slash half off everything. So I'm not talking just about a specific product that you might not necessarily need or buy.
But it's not otherwise. Once a year. Boxing Day sales.
But this, I'm a much bigger fan of Boxing Day sales because, you know, they cut things, you know, stuff they're just trying to get rid of. And, you know, I tend to find a few bargains Boxing Day. I'm a traditionalist, you know, in Britain. I think this Black Friday thing that's come over from America, it's come over from Amazon, you know, they're the ones that pushed it from 5 years ago. And I just think, you know, we were talking about it on the way here. I actually think it deters some people from going shopping today because they don't want to get caught up in the madness.
Is it here to stay, though?
No. I reckon 5 years' time, I reckon it'll be really on the way. And as Simon says, this is prime time now. As we run up at Christmas, this is when you should be charging full price for stuff, not slashing prices.
It's already morphing into something else. Simon, here to stay?
I don't think so. We asked our readers, do you like Black Friday? Yes or no? 87% no, 13% yes. I tell you one thing, though, about Cyber Monday and Manic Monday. Quick quiz question to finish off the show. Do you know who wrote the song Manic Monday?
Share Radio.